Book of the Week with Claire Armistead on guardian.co.uk.
My guest today might seem to have wandered into a books podcast by mistake because he's best known for his music. He's Nick Cave, the Australian-born singer-songwriter and leader of the legendary Bad Seeds. But yes, he is in the right studio because he's here today to discuss his second novel, The Death of Buddy Munro, published this week. Welcome, Nick.
Hi, how are you?
Now, let's first get this straight. Buddy Munro is not simply a book, is it? It doesn't simply exist as a set of pages. There's also an audiobook version which you read yourself and for which you've composed the music.
Yeah, with Warren Ellis, actually, who I collaborate on all sorts of things with, mostly film scores. He's also in The Bad Seeds. And Grinder Man. In fact,
old gang just reunited in a different medium.
It's Warren. It's Warren especially. So he's had a huge input on the audio book. Well, you can see that it's a happy novel.
Tell us about the technology of this. You talk about it as being a whole audio experience.
I'm a great fan of audiobooks, and I've listened to a lot of audiobooks, or read them, as you say. But they basically have a bit of music at the start, and then an actor reads the book, and then they have a bit of music at the end. But we've done a big kind of mega production job on the whole thing. It's also been spatialized, so if you hear it with headphones, it sounds like a hallucination.
So for example, there's a bit quite near the beginning where Bunny hears water plinking through the ceiling from the flat above.
Well, exactly. I mean, the music ends up being directional, but there's also the sound becomes directional, but there's also a kind of physicalness about it in a strange way. If you listen to it with headphones, that water will sound like it's literally tapping you on the top of the head. Mm. I mean, it's quite extraordinary, and it serves the novel well because the novel has a very hallucinatory, sometimes kind of psychedelic feel in it, and it's like a dream, the novel.
So now let's go right back to basics and say this is the story of a very messed up man. Is that a true reflection? Tell us a bit about Buddy Munro.
Well, what I tried to do with Buddy Munro is to make a character that was recognisable, certainly to men, and to my delight, I found that this character is actually recognisable to women as well, but that there was something within the character of Buddy Munro that men related to, and then to take that character and blow him out of the water.
Now, he's a travelling salesman, and he spends most of the novel in a yellow punto, which somehow seems significant. Let's hear a little bit of Bunny in his prime location, the car.
Out of the radio comes a song that Bunny cannot identify, and suddenly the whole thing is lost in a blast of static, and Bunny rabbit punches the radio and says, "Fuck," whereupon heavy classical music blasts out. The music sounds like it is trumpeting the advent of something way beyond the bounds of terrible. Bunny looks askance at the car radio. He feels spooked by it, the way it seems to choose at random what it wants to hear, and he turns the volume down. "Fucking radio," says Bunny.
Nice.
No, he's not a very nice man, is he? He's an alcoholic. He's a sex addict, probably, with an obsession with vaginas. And there's one particularly nasty scene where he sees, well, for me, which has stayed with me, actually, where he sees his wife's Anne Summers clothes after her suicide hung up with their crotches gaping, which seems to sum up some part of his pre-epic imagination.
Well, you know, there's a lot of... just because he's an alcoholic and a sex addict. Did you say sex addict?
I said sex addict.
Yeah, I would have thought that's a kind of more, it's a little modern, that term for him. He's more a sex maniac, I think.
Sex maniac, right, yeah. But it is set in the present.
It is set in the present, but a sex addict suggests that he maybe is somehow conscious of his problem or whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't think he is conscious of his problem at all. But, he's unpleasant and he does unpleasant things, but... there's a sort of spark of humanity in this character that hopefully, you can perhaps not sympathise with, but feel a certain affection for on occasion through the novel.
Mm. And it's one of the best evocations of addiction to me, or of being in a drugged up state. Now, I feel that's come from your experience, hasn't it? You have experience of those states.
Well, I experimented with some drugs.
From now and then.
I mean, I do understand that. I do understand, without going into this too deeply, but I do understand fathering in that state. You know, I mean, I haven't taken drugs for a long time, but I have some quite older children, and I do understand doing the school run slightly worse for wear. You know, so I do. I drew on that to a degree.
And of course, as you say, you mentioned fathering. It's also the story of a child, and there are two narrative voices. One is Bunny's, and one is Bunny Junior's, who is incredibly touching. Again, this feels as if it's a sort of a very felt piece of writing and characterization.
Well, what I tried to do was to, you know, very often the central character Bunny is seen through his son's eyes, and the son, who is nine, can only see his father as being the best dad in the world, and we know what his father's getting up to, but that is totally irrelevant to the child's view of what his father is. So we can feel somehow sympathetic because we're seeing this character through the eyes of a child.
And is that something you feel of your own children?
Yeah, I do. I think, you know, at that particular age, they're kind of trembling on the edge of innocence, and they're by the time they're 10, 11 and 12, the kind of scales fall from their eyes and they start to see what their parents actually are.
And your children are nine. The second brood are nine at the moment.
Yeah, I know both sides of it.
Yeah, he has this this sort of rather touching sensitivity to his father's short fuse. So, for example, he has an eye problem, and instead of saying, I really need to go to a doctor, Dad, he'll say, I think I might need a white stick and a dog soon, Dad.
Yeah. Well, he exaggerates, like all children do, their conditions, I always find. So you can't... people have been very upset by the fact that it looks like the child is actually going blind through the novel. But my feeling is he's kind of exaggerating the situation.
And, of course, Bunny Jr. is party to all his father's obscenities, isn't he? He laughs. He laughs louder than anybody else at his father's filthy jokes.
Well, your children do, don't they?
Would you show this to your children, this work of fiction, to your nine-year-olds?
I wouldn't show this book, no. It's just not appropriate. But the children love to be drawn into the adult world, you know. They love nothing more than feeling like they're experiencing something that perhaps they shouldn't be experiencing. I mean, I know that from my own father, who used to, at a very young age, read me certain types of literature, which was basically adult literature. When I look at it now, he read me extracts from Lolita, for example, when I was 11 or 12, and said, like, this is what it's all about. And in some respects, that may have been inappropriate, but on the other hand, it was a wonderful time to be kind of invited into my father's world, you know.
I couldn't in the end decide whether in the end you thought families were rubbish or were actually the road to redemption. And there's a real ambivalence at the heart of this novel about them.
I think as parents we probably put too much credit on ourselves about the influence we actually have over our children. I think children are very much creatures unto themselves and that could benefit from us standing back, and I think that society these days increasingly kind of stultifies and suffocates children. I'm not putting Bunny Munro up as a role model for fatherhood.
Did you like your own parents?
Yes, very much.
So you didn't have this sort of ambivalent relationship with them?
My relationship became more complicated with my father as I grew into my teens, and then he died when I was 19, so... The whole thing was left fairly open-ended. But, you know, I look back at my childhood and I grew up in the country.
In
Australia as a kind of country boy and loved that. Up until about 11 or 12 when it all started going horribly wrong.
So just tell me, what did your father do? What was his job?
Well, initially he was an English literature teacher.
Right.
Or actually an English teacher and mathematics teacher at a really nasty little high school in a nasty little country town in Australia. But he ended up being the adult education director of Victoria.
And hence the access to literature. I was wondering what other books you were influenced by, what your childhood reading was, apart from these rather risque things your father read to you.
Well, I loved the William Rice Burroughs books, the Tarzan books. I found mesmerising. I mean, I remember, you know, when I don't know how old this was, pretty young, but reading those books and actually coming across certain lines in those books that I just found really kind of exciting.
Now, it's interesting to me that you grew up in Australia and that, yeah, this is a Brighton novel. I mean, I don't think I have read such a strongly located Brighton novel since Graham Greene's Brighton Rock, with which it does have certain similarities. Is that something you were aware of? Pinky, if Graham Greene's Pinky had lived to adulthood, he may well have ended up like Bunny Munro. Bunny Munro even has a quiff.
Well, I didn't really try and do that. I personally actually love Brighton, I can't really imagine living anywhere else these days. But the Brighton in this particular novel is seen through the eyes of a tortured human being whose life is rapidly going down the toilet. So it's kind of represented in a not so flattering way. So my apologies
to Brighton,
to the Brighton City Council and the tourists.
But you name check, you know. I mean, I live near Brighton, so I know Devil's Dyke and Churchill Square and Rottingdean Beach. You know, seen many a barbecue in my youth. It's very, very evoked in detail.
Well, you can't let an opportunity to go past with the town called Rottingdean. it has its kind of, as you go into Rottingdean, there's a dentist there, which is sort of the Rottingdean dentist, and it's quite a place.
It's not just the location that made me think of Graham Greene, but it's also a sense of a sort of religiosity, a fury, a sense of evil and of damnation that I get from this novel.
The writing style is ramped up, and it's to me it's like a hallucination of some sort, or in some kind of way, if you want to sort of stretch that a little bit, like a religious experience. And the way he approaches his desires with such conviction is in a religious way, I guess. But I don't think in any way it's a Christian novel, or it has a kind of, it's not a redemptive novel in a Christian kind of way. Bunny Munro dies unredeemed. He's suddenly wiped off the face of the planet. There's no redemption scenes other than a kind of pseudo one at the end of the book, which I don't really want to go.
We shouldn't really go there, should we? I think it's fascinating, that final scene, but we must let readers read it for themselves.
Yeah.
Are you religious?
No.
Not at all.
Well, you know, I mean, look, I. As a person sitting here now, no, I'm not. But I do write songs, and I have, over the years, I have a kind of community that I look over, which are the characters that crawl out of my largely narrative songs. And within that environment, I think some kind of God exists. And sometimes it's malevolent, and sometimes it's kind, and sometimes it's just there by its absence in some kind of way. But do I personally believe in a personal God? No, I don't.
Now, one of the features of Bunny, perhaps his biggest failing, is that he is devoid of imagination. Several times this comes up. All he can imagine is female anatomy, really.
Yeah, on a good day. Well, I mean, occasionally he can visualise celebrity female anatomy. But yeah, he admits that he has no sexual imagination whatsoever, which I found kind of weirdly endearing about him.
Mm-hmm.
His desires are simplistic and infantile.
And now you name check people who you know, don't you? You name check Kylie Minogue, for example. That's one of his fantasy figures. Is that partly an in joke with Kylie, or is that?
I wish it was an in joke with Kylie. In the sense that, I don't know, I mean, I've sent the book to Kylie and I've sent her a letter of apology on behalf of my central character.
It might be the end of a beautiful friendship. On the other hand,
I hope not. I really hope not, because I'm a huge admirer of Kylie Minogue's.
Mm-hmm.
Kylie Minogue.
Do you think that this will change the way you look at songwriting?
Songwriting?
Yeah. Do you think it will influence, having written this novel?
Well, you know, everything influences everything else. But what happens when I've done something, that a kind of extracurricular thing, which I would call something like this, because I basically see myself as a songwriter, is it makes me want to run screaming back to music and songwriting. So that's what I've been involved in since the novel.
Is it harder than songwriting?
No. Writing a novel's infinitely easier for me.
Why is it easier?
Well, because you have some kind of control over the outcome of a book and of a story. You can, with writing, you really don't. You never know. In fact, you can write a lyric that you're really pleased with, and you can take it into the studio and sing it, and it just sounds like absolute nonsense. It just doesn't work as a song. So there's a huge amount of anxiety around songwriting for me. You can write something that you consider to be a minor thing and sing it, and it suddenly has all the meaning in the world. So you never really know.
I wondered also how you found the solitariness of writing a novel, which after all is quite different to being in a band.
Well, actually, it wasn't. I wrote it on the tour bus. So I wrote by longhand that novel on a 6-week tour around Europe and America. So I wrote it basically in hotel rooms, on the tour bus, backstage, in a notebook.
And the CDs actually have, presumably, your original manuscript sort of on the covers of each individual CD. They're actually rather beautiful objects
nice,
in their own right, aren't they? I was wondering whether I could actually get to the bit of the plot that this was, but I can't actually
read
your handwriting.
Well, it's all in there.
But it's lots of scribblings out.
Well, there's little notes like, have him masturbate at funeral.
I mean, you actually are a bit of a Renaissance man, aren't you? There are references here to not just to other novels, but to, for example, I see a lot of Hitchcock in the music, what I think of as the horror music, which crops up every now and then. I could see you moving your fingers on the table as if you were sort of playing it.
Yeah, well, I was just... it is Hitchcock-like, that, actually.
Was that deliberate?
No, not really. But that's put there to let you know, in case you haven't worked it out, something bad's going to happen.
And it's applied, but it's also applied to things like seagulls. I have to say that seagulls in Brighton do have a particular horror.
Well, they've always terrified me, the seagull. I'm learning to cope with them. They're especially big in Brighton. In Australia, we have small, rather cute ones, actually. But in Brighton, they're big and nasty.
And they're pensioner-killing ones in Bunny
yeah.
Munro. So will you be writing more fiction, or is this the end of it?
No, I'd like to write some more. I mean, it took a long time to work out for me. You know, it took 20 years from the first one to work out that to write a book could actually be enjoyable. And it's a wonderful, sustaining way to enter a world, a different kind of world. The songs are songs. You can do that for a short time, and then you have to sort of start all over again. And there's something about sticking with a character that was hugely sort of satisfying with me.
Mm. And I have to say that Bunny Munro is the most memorable character I've encountered all year.
Oh, really?
Yes, I'm not just flattering, actually. That's true. He's the stuff of nightmares. I don't think I'll be sleeping well for the next few nights. But Nick, anyway, thank you very much for coming in. And to play you out, we've got one little more piece of music from the audiobook version of The Death of Bunny Munro.